The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
As we start the first Taisho of this Sesshin, two traditions of our way. One is that we sit in Zazen as we listen to the Taisho, letting it wash over us. And here at the temple at Sesshin, we are going to share our Dharma talks. Melissa and I will be sharing the talk this morning. So here we are, celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment. Rohatsu, every year on the 8th day of the 12th month. And this is our origin story of our way. So we're going to start with a koan from the collection Transmitting the Light. It is the first koan. Keizan Jokin was our Japanese ancestor in 13th century Japan who compiled koans, each of which was meant to reflect the enlightenment of successive ancestors. So, of course, the first koan is about the Buddha's enlightenment. And that's the koan we will take up and explore together at this Sesshin. So the case. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened. And he said, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. And then Keizan gives us the circumstances of the situation. He writes, Shakyamuni Buddha was of the sun race in India. At the age of 19, he leaped over the palace walls in the dead of night. And at Mount Dantaloka, he cut off his hair. Subsequently, he practiced austerities for 6 years. And later, he sat on the Vajra seat where spiders spun webs in his eyebrows and magpies built a nest on top of his head. Reeds grew up between his legs as he sat tranquilly and erect without movement for 6 years. At the age of 30, on the 8th day of the 12th month, as the morning star appeared, he was suddenly enlightened. These words are his very first lion's roar. And those words again are, I and the great earth and beings simultaneously achieve the way. And then Keizan shares with us a verse that's such an important part of this story. The verse is, a splendid branch issues from the old plum tree, at the same time obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. So, that's the case. But there is a background to this which most of us know, but let me just remind you. Because, why did this 19-year-old leap over the palace walls? What was he getting away from? And what was he moving toward? So the story is that Siddhartha was his name before he was the Buddha. That he was a prince and that his father, the king, wanted to shield him from the hard parts of life, from the parts of life that are difficult to face. And so the king created a world within the palace walls without old age, sickness, or death. Anybody who grew old, who got sick, who died, was whisked away, hidden from the Buddha's sight. And then at 19, the Buddha leaps over walls to get away from this paradise. And his chariot driver takes him on a tour of the city, and he sees old people and sick people and dying. And that's when he goes on his quest. A 12-year quest that culminates in sitting under the Bodhi tree, seeing the morning star, and waking up. A story that is so alive for us now, for each of us. Each of us has leapt over walls to get to this practice. Each of us has had the intimation that we are not seeing our life as it is. That in that way, we are perhaps not truly alive. And although we're not princes and princesses, the culture does ask us to look away. Don't face everything. Let's hide away death. Let's hide away aging. Let's hide away my sadness, my uncertainty, my confusion. And so we can look at the world and think that everybody else is fine, but our hearts tell us that there is an authentic way to be with our life. And so we jump over walls and we come to practice, searching for that sense of authenticity, that sense of being truly alive. And we sit 25 minutes, sometimes seems like 6 years. And sometimes it seems like weeds are growing up all around us as we sit and sit and sit. The story here is that the Buddha saw the morning star and he was enlightened. But there's more to this story in some traditions, where he is visited by demons and temptations. And he sees their true nature. He sees the moon in the dewdrop. And seeing through appearances to the essence of what's real is what allows him to wake up. And so, why does Kazan give us a verse about thorns? A splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. Oh, that sounds like the morning star. That sounds like what I'm here for. But at the same time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere? Of course they do. And what the Buddha learned when he said, "I and the world wake up together," which is what he said, is that there is no separation, that there's no separation between the splendid branch and those painful thorns. All are part of this vast universe that we can only see a hint of not separate, and all there as Dharma gates to wake us up. So here we are. We've jumped over the walls. We've come to Sesshin. We're sitting down. Busy minds. Muddy water. But we let the water settle. And as we let it settle, and as we allow ourselves to be open to the thorns as well as the beautiful branches, to the knee pain as well as the sunrise, the Dharma calls to us. Our lives call to us. And we have the chance to feel truly alive. And now Melissa will tell you what that means.
It's pretty simple, actually. Well, this is the point, hearing it outlined so beautifully by Bob, where hopefully, I really hope this is true for you, some questions might be arising in your own heart. So here's this character from 2,600 years ago who leapt over the palace walls. We looked at a few translations of this koan, and every one translated some word in Chinese. Keizan translated this into Japanese from Chinese as leaping over. And all of us have to take that deeply to heart. What does it mean to leap over the boundaries that we've constructed for ourselves that keep us trapped in a sense of who we think we are, and maybe even more concernedly, who we want to be when we, in quotes, wake up? There are so many stories about waking up in Zen. You don't get this so much in other forms of Buddhism, but Zen seems to be saturated with awakening stories. Some of the translations of this koan talk about the Buddha's enlightenment, and Rahatsu, the eighth day of the 12th month, is celebrated as the day of his enlightenment. I was getting my hair cut the other day and tried to explain to my hairdresser about Buddhist holidays in Zen. This is our basic, big, huge holiday. The day, which is kind of funny, the day that our ancestor, our legendary ancestor, woke up just by looking up and seeing the morning star, but not just by looking up. In some stories of the Buddha's life, he was 29 when he leapt over the palace wall, and he had a wife and he had a son, and he left behind everything, all the old limitations of the self. There's a lot of discussion about this. How could he abandon them? And even if we stay in our families, there's some way that this practice asks us to abandon that ordinary way that we think about ourselves. Something is pulling at us much more strongly than the conventional pulls that we go through when we mature into adults. Something has been pulling at us maybe from the first time that we gained consciousness somewhere back in the fog of infancy and toddlerhood. This understanding that we had an effect on the world, so that must mean that we're separate from the world, because when I throw a toy on the floor, my mother picks it up and gives it back to me, and then I throw it again, and lo and behold, it happens again. Many, many times we begin to understand our efficacy in the world. And then this efficacy turns over the years into a sense of self that is separate from everything else. And we tell the story of ourself. We tell a story about who we think we are. And for many of us, not everyone, but many of us, that story is not a happy story. That story has lots of evidence for where we screw up and where we get lost and where we're deluded. And we long, perhaps, to be the subject of all these wonderful enlightenment stories where something transforms at the deepest seat of consciousness. It says in one of the sutras, something transforms so deeply that we are no longer that horrible, messed up person that we've been telling the endless stories about, but we are an enlightened person, and then we're really in trouble. But that's another story. Because what we're really looking at here when we look at these stories of awakening is what happens after. And it's the poem, as Bob pointed out, that contains some of the key to this. Those thorns, the beautiful plum branches, that's how we think it's going to be. And then, wait a minute, we trip over the dog and we shout an obscenity. And then we think, oh, maybe I'm not enlightened after all. Damn it, I have to start all over. But what if the teachings that we hear, and we really do hear these teachings and then we delete them from consciousness because they don't fit our stories, the teaching about the Buddha seeing the morning star, whether it was after 12 years or 6 years, or in some collections it says 6 days, doesn't matter, because as Bob said, it can feel like a century to even sit with our minds and our stories, these painful stories, for a few minutes, to turn towards the walls that we've built around ourselves and see them for what they are. What if even that was the complete expression of the awakened heart? What if it doesn't look different than this? So all of us in this room have ideas about who we think we are. There's no question. And we can tell those stories endlessly. And we're very convinced because we have historical evidence to back it up. When I was 7, when I was 30, doesn't matter. They fit neatly into the terrible story, the terrible narrative of the self. What if all of that was the awakened heart manifesting itself? This is the unbelievable, crazy, weird, ununderstandable story of the awakened heart in Zen. When the Buddha looked up at the morning star, he didn't see a star shining separate from himself. Suddenly, everything in the world was him. And that means, the way we take that into our practice later, that means that everything that we experience is equal to the morning star, equal to the Buddha, equal to everything that we identify as precious and good. So looking into your heart right now, what's your condition? It's only been, it might feel like a lifetime, but it's really only been a few hours into our sesshin. We just started last night at 9 o'clock. And now it's a little bit more than 12, 13 hours later. And what is our condition? Well, maybe you are feeling just absolutely happy and giddy, and you saw the sunrise this morning and everything dissolved and you realized what the Buddha realized, the great lion's roar. Everything has woken up with me. And if that happened for you, fantastic. Congratulations. Or maybe you woke up this morning from troubled sleep and your body aches and you couldn't get to the bathroom when you thought you should be able to because there aren't enough toilets, damn it, and you couldn't wash your hands and you couldn't take your usual shower and the food, there wasn't enough oatmeal. Oh my God, I didn't get what I needed. And you're angry or you're tired or you're sad because this fits into your story of everything always happens to me and it's so terrible. I don't care what it is. Every single thing that's arising for you right now is equivalent to the morning star that shone for the Buddha. It is the awakened nature. This is what the awakened nature looks like, feels like, sounds like, smells like. The thorns and brambles and the plum blossoms are all growing up together. This opportunity that we're experiencing here of Sesshin, of unifying the heart-mind, as we say in one of our translations of the word Sesshin, unifying everything, experiencing everything as this. This is it. It's not some other place, although just wait a moment and it'll be there. The moon shines on the water and doesn't break up the water, Dogen tells us. Everything is manifesting as our true selves, the self that is not stuck in the walled kingdom of the narrative self. And so we may have these moments when we see the sunrise or smell the plum blossoms or feel how yummy the oatmeal is, and then followed by something else. All of those wonderful things are important. All of those openings are important. We might, as we say, settle down and feel the settling down as wonderful. But the agitation also is the awakened heart. There is nothing left out of this. This is unbelievable. But this is apparently what the Buddha discovered 2,600 years ago when he said, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously attain the way. Thank you. So please make yourselves relatively comfortable. That is, come out of your Zazen posture, turning in this direction for our Dharma dialogue. We're going to share together questions that might arise for you after our talk, anything to do with your practice that you want to talk about or ask about. And the four of us up here who are taking the role of your teachers, and we're happy to do that temporarily this morning. And you may end up being teachers for all of us. If you come forward and really be honest about what your own experience is, and if you don't do that, we may redirect you. So please, raise your hand, we'll call on you. What's going on for you this morning in regard to Rahatsu and the Morning Star and the Buddha? Yes.
One thing that I was thinking of when you were telling the story, and thank you both for the Dharma talks, they were really wonderful. One version of the story that I heard, sort of the prequel to the Buddha leaping over the walls of the palace, is that his father, when Siddhartha was born, received a prophecy that his son was going to be either a warrior of some kind or some sort of a spiritual or religious leader. And so the father did not want him to be a religious leader. I don't know why, but he decided that shielding him from suffering or seeing suffering would be the way to dissuade him from taking an interest in religion, with the thinking that, you know, why would you need religion if, you know, there's no suffering in the world? So that was possibly, you know, the reasoning there. So as I was thinking about that, I was sort of pondering the importance of him seeing that suffering and experiencing it for himself. I mean, sitting there for 6 years can't have been easy. I'm sure he suffered a lot and saw a lot of suffering. And I just was thinking about how important that is, as much as, you know, it's really difficult, obviously, who wants to suffer. But I don't know that we can have compassion and understanding without ourselves having suffering and seeing others suffering. So even though his father tried to shield him from that, and of course, you know, his father cared about him, I'm sure, and wanted to do a good thing, ultimately, you know, it's pretty great that he leaped out there and was like, no, I need to experience this and see what it's all about, and gave himself a much more difficult life. But we wouldn't have had the Buddha otherwise, so I think, there's... suffering is important.
Well, it's also such an important pointer because, you know, if you think about it, even if everything around you is paradise, has any of us not suffered from a stomachache, from a cold, from a, right? You know, so Siddhartha is going to get some inkling somewhere that, oh wait, there's more to this than paradise, right? That because what arises within me includes pain and suffering. And how do I meet that if I have no help understanding and meeting it from the world?
And I think it's the fundamental shift in perspective of Buddhism that our culture generally says, any suffering is bad. And we as human beings have this tendency to avoid pain and seek pleasure, which is wonderful. But as you point out, this capacity to experience difficulty is the entry gate. So quite a different thing when I experience difficulty, rather than think, well, there's something wrong with me or something wrong with my practice, as Melissa was saying, that this very difficulty, whatever we call that, is the entry point.
And thanks for bringing in these other stories about the Buddha. There are so many wonderful stories about his life. Some of them come from the Theravada tradition, the way of the elders. Some of them come from Zen. Some of them come from Tibetan Buddhism. It's hard to know what really happened. But we do want to use them just the way you're using them for ourselves. The story that I heard was that he was going to be either a king or a religious leader. And, of course, his father was greedy for power, so he wanted him to be a king. But the other story is that when he was a young boy, he was out in the fields watching the plowing of the fields, and he could see the little worms getting cut up by the plow. And that sometimes, some people consider that the first time he woke up out of paradise. He felt the suffering of those little worms as his own. And that's another thing. So we look inward at our own suffering, and we look outward at the suffering in the world, and we watch. So the wall, we were talking about more looking in, the walls of the narrative self, but there's also the wall of other people, other beings, not me. So there's the me and the not me, and to realize this is an amazing teaching, not what we, most of us, grew up with, that suffering pervades the universe, and it's heartbreaking, and it's not something to be avoided or fixed. Something to be met. And then things melt. The walls melt. First we have to leap over them. Then we look back, what walls? But thank you.
I have two sort of related thoughts. The first was about being a parent and how hard it is for us to let our children suffer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it feels virtually impossible, even if we say to ourselves, this is how people learn, is just so hard. And then I think as we grow up, we have a kind of mixed attitude, and I don't think everybody's the same around it, but I think a lot of us who come to Zen come here because of some kind of suffering that we imagine is going to go away. We've built our stories around our specific sufferings, and certainly Bob and I know very much how that becomes solidified in therapy sometimes, and you know, that those sufferings are exactly who you are. And I think what has felt really different about learning about it within this community is that it's not about yourself. It's a way that you feel part of humanity, mankind, the world, not just even those little worms. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different shift in perspective to think that your suffering is who you are, to think of your suffering as what makes you a human being like other human beings, not separate.
Yeah, and suffering as a connector. Why, that's a radical idea. Yeah.
And I think to see, we all get quite attached to our drama. You know, and we're quite confirmed when the usual thing happens. You know, it sucks, but God damn it, I'm right. Right? You know, and I think to see how challenging it is to let it be without we cling to it, and even to see how we cling to our drama is huge, because we think, well, I don't like this at all. I really don't like this thing that's so precious to me. So that to see that insight is huge.
So when you brought up the worms, I think something kind of clicked for me, because I've been trying to wrap my head around kind of empathy in this context and kind of who you empathize with and the idea of suffering, but I find it's very hard to empathize sometimes with the person causing the suffering, even though sometimes, like, we all cause suffering. And when you brought up that, you know, his father really wanted him to be a king, it's like now he's causing his father suffering. And I think that, like, it's very easy to not want to do that. It's not, but you don't then reflect on, like, when you're causing the suffering. And so I feel like it being a connector is a really convenient way to think about it, but it's also, it is what you're doing too.
Yes. Yeah. Well, right, and in implicit in the story of the Buddha, he left his wife and son. You know, it's like, whoa. He just, you know, left them in paradise, but still. He was gone, and there's lots of stories. You can also hear lots of Teisho about that little event. Well, it wasn't little, it was huge. You know, later they showed up at his community and became part of the community. Studied with him, became his students, although he turned his wife away at first because he was a Hindu of the time and women weren't supposed to be part of the deal. But then never looked it up, but I think it was Ananda, his attendant, who said, "This is a mistake. Don't do this. It's not going to look good in the future."
The optics are not good.
The optics are not good. You turn your mom away. Actually, it was his aunt, because his mom had died.
Participating in the suffering, empathizing with the suffering, seeing it. It doesn't seem to be more like it just connects people. It is like the thing.
That's right. Yeah, it is the thing. That's so important. Thank you.
For me, it's we talk about it as a Dharma gate, not as a gate that you pass through and then goes away, but as an ongoing, often. Presence in the universe, in the world, in our lives, some suffering that we can be aware of. And of course the hope, probably for every one of us, is that when we sit on the cushion we're not going to have to feel it. But we are so deeply interwoven and there are always people suffering and it's just in the air and we feel it. We don't even know why sometimes and our hearts just break open in some way. And then that becomes our practice. That becomes our practice of looking into this suffering and seeing its nature, seeing its thusness, and awakening to the thusness of suffering is enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Not just suffering. There's also oatmeal.
Well, if you're lucky enough to.
I'm totally dissatisfied with this situation.
Demonstration. Susan.
Just listening to what other people have said, two things occur to me. One is, I think part of what makes it so hard to face things is you think, I don't have the strength to do that. I can't do that. But if you don't expend so much energy trying to protect yourself and rail against what happens, then maybe you can use that to feel the pain that comes. And the other thing seems to come from a totally different place, but I don't think it is. One of the texts on which the Messiah is based is, "Comfort ye my people."
Yes. Yeah, this is something that connects all spiritual paths. Yeah. There's comfort in the facing, mm-hmm. Right in the joining with.
You know, I want to just say it's so, what you're pointing to is so important in terms of why we sit absolutely still. If you think about it, that we, you know, most of the time we're running around, and if we have an unpleasant feeling, we reach for our phone or we, you know, eat something. And so to sit still, I'm just talking about myself.
That was clear.
But to sit still and to face what arises, including bits of suffering, is to say, I can bear this. I can look, and I can keep looking, and I can look again. That is, again, a radical act that we do every time we sit down.
I'm really struck, too, Susan. I think there's a pervasive idea we have when we have to face something that's just impossible, to say, I can't do it. And actually, that's true. Right? We can't do it. We can't get through it. We can't get over it. We can't get under it. We can't get around it. You know, it dissolves us. You know, whatever the situation is. And I always remember when I used to have a career as a grief counselor, and how many times people said to me, "I can't let myself cry because if I start to cry, I'm just never going to stop." Mm-hmm. And I would say, "Try it." Based on my own experience, I always stopped. Sometimes I just fell into bed like exhausted, but it always stopped. I never heard anybody come back from that saying, "Oh no, it just never stopped." So there is a limitation to, you know, we think it's unbearable, it's unbearable, it's unbearable. We heard something on NPR the other day about a hospital in Africa where there's just not enough equipment, and that some people just spend their whole day crying, you know, and we know that that is sometimes the way it feels. So, going back to what Mike said, you know, that is not a problem or a mistake either. That is, it's not oatmeal, but it's so precious to be alive. Mm-hmm. To be alive. We spend so much of our life objecting to things about life. Mm-hmm. And look at us here. We're all alive. That's pretty cool. Complain all you want. Wow, what a treat. There were some hands in this general area. Yes?
A comment and then a question. A comment that it was first time for me reading sutra with so many people around, and it felt powerful. Did not expect it at all. So, thank you. And then when I told my friend that I'm doing a Zen retreat, she didn't ask why retreat, but she asked why Zen. Mm-hmm. And I told her I'm going to ask the teachers. since you guys weren't born into it, you weren't conditioned to choose Zen out of so many other practices. Why Zen for you? Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, I'm not going to answer that. I think it's a wonderful question, and one for all of us. And I think, you know, there is this term Zen, but I have no idea what it really means. But what brought you here? Why haven't you left already? And for each one of us, Zen or not Zen is not really very important, because there's something else going on here. And what is it that brought you here? What is it that keeps you here? This is indeed a wonderful question. So thank you.
And I would just say, I'm not going to answer it either, so sorry. I'm not sorry. I'm happy not to answer it. But I do want to want to caution anybody here who thinks if you figured out why Zen, just like shelve that and keep asking. Don't be satisfied with any answer. When you ask the question, I don't know how many people may have done this in their minds, but what I did was I thought back to the first time I read about Zen or thought about Zen or blah, blah, blah. And I could cement it. I could make a narrative that would be very, be a great story. But it's not satisfying to have those stories, even about Zen. So. But thank you for the question.
Yeah.
Very important question. Yeah, right.
Not to answer the question, the thought that came to me is that Zen chose me. I think the whole idea while we're talking about is that we're somehow in charge, we're somehow in control, that Buddha somehow, this craving to jump over the wall and change his perspective, came from himself. And we're touching something else that moves and animates us to be here or to make the changes that we're making. And that being, like you've referred to as some bigger, whatever that is bigger than who we are. It's not the small mind that's in charge. There's something bigger about who we are that judges us. And it's beyond words. There's no name for it, no understanding of it. And for me, it's the practice is growing to trust that, whatever that is, and let it lead.
Yeah. It's very related to the "I can't do it," right? I can't bear it. No, you don't. No need to. Right, the world comes to meet us. In fact, Dogen says that in somewhere earlier in the Genjo Koan, right, where he talks about delusion is going out to meet the things of the world, and enlightenment is receiving the things of the world. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, Will?
I was just thinking, though, that there's also a set of those thorns, which are sort of, I can do it, in the sense that, or I must do it. I think I have a habit of coming to Sesshin thinking, oh, I've gotten really out of balance, but now I'm going to really sort of fix things. And then I waste, I spend a lot of time trying to fix things. And it really is not very helpful to keep that hamster wheel going. That's so the I can is perilous, just like the I can't, I guess.
Yes.
Paul.
Thank you for your talk and all the comments. I'm finding myself appreciating the wall.
Yeah.
Where I live, I spend most of my summer and fall outside, and that's what I want to be doing. As far as outside. When I moved to Vermont, I learned about this other season, this kind of transition, Bardo zone, where the leaves have fallen, but the snow has not. It's called stick season. It's quickly become one of my favorite seasons. And one of the reasons why is that when the leaves fall, all of a sudden, I see all of these stone walls all through the hills and valleys that's there. And these walls have been there for over 150 years, most of them. And no one recalls who put them there. No one knows who did that work as such. And they just go through the mountain, and you can't differentiate as far as where the road was, where the woods were. It doesn't have a purpose. That these walls seemingly don't have a purpose. And I so appreciate them because it allows me to see the walls that I have built. And I find that what I'm doing here is this important step in this important process of noticing my walls. Where can I leap? Often I find that I just leap without understanding where these walls are. So in your story and in the telling of the story, I really appreciate the walls. I have to see the walls. I have to see the thorns. That's there. That's part of this daily life that I live.
Thank you, Paul. You know, for the mind is so easily seduced into forming something to get rid of.
Yeah.
Something that is other, that if I could get rid of this thing, some kind of thorn or wall, or if I could get beyond this, then I would be enlightened. And I think for me, your pointer is right at the heart of this work is, you know, whatever is arising is exactly what is. And is exactly our opportunity. And we don't have to work to transform it. We don't have to make it into something else. I think we can turn it into a project rather than just being it, just meeting it, and doing our best to see what is as clearly as we can. That's the whole deal. And of course you're like, shit, but then I'm not going to get anywhere. And then you say, oh yeah.
And all of these things that we call walls or problems or whatever, again, going back to what some of us were saying about we're not in charge of doing it, so that we don't. I love what you say about not taking it on as a project, but it does shift and change. Those walls were built by farmers, you know, who wanted to keep their cows and whatever they were doing. We won't know because they're all gone, right? But they were markers of some kind. Now they have a different purpose. They've been transformed by the world. And I think about this, it just sprang up when you were talking, Paul, this poem by Antonio Machado, where he talks about, there's a beehive in my heart, and the bees are making honey from my old failures.
Oh,
isn't that amazing? You know, that nothing is wasted.
Yeah.
If there wasn't a wall, the Buddha wouldn't have had anything to leap over. You know, if there wasn't the terrible things that happened to us in our narrative, maybe we wouldn't have found Zen. Well, you know, it's just there's nothing extra and nothing is missing. Everything. And because we're being held by this greater, unimaginable, unknowable grace.
I just want to speak briefly about geology.
Sure.
Lay it on us.
Well, Paul's talking about rock walls in Vermont, and of course they're ubiquitous in New England. The reason that the walls are there is because the ground itself grows rocks. Every year, they frost heave upward, okay? And this is just a natural process, okay? And they're a real problem for the farmers because they break plows and, you know, it causes, you know, in order to grow crops and so on and so forth, you got to get rid of the rocks. So you move the rocks. Where are you going to move them to? All right, well, it's a very practical thing to just pile them up in walls, okay? So, these walls that we talk about, okay, they're natural. They just happen.
Yeah.
So that's all I really want to say about that, okay? I don't want to talk much more about the metaphor itself, but I want to...
Can we though, Chris?
Can we?
It's a really cool...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to riff on it for one second. Because, you know, if we expand the metaphor, because how do we, can we use our vulnerabilities? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the first teachings I got, and I'm a physician, so we've been trained to fix. That's our thing, right? And one of the first questions I got from a Zen teacher was, what if there's nothing to fix? And when I came to view the people who came to me
And I came to view myself that way. It was like a whole, it was like waking up. And I think what I began to understand was that we all can use these vulnerabilities to know them more fully. And then, you know, rather than having them break the plow, allowing them to be in places where we can be more present, more awake, more alive to each other because of those vulnerabilities, because of those roughs.
And just to point out a connection to what Will was saying about the dangers of I can being as bad as I can't. And there's also I can't and I can coming together in the story of the rocks you told. You know, that, yeah, the rocks come up from the earth. And then farmers roll them over and pile them up. So there's this beautiful interaction. We are a part. We can't divide ourselves from the activity of awakening. You know, everything is involved, including our own mistakes and failures and good intentions. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Honey, walls. I gotta say it. No, I'm...
Well, and in the garden, I carefully put little rocks marking the edge of pathways. And what I find is that they sink down into the earth. And so every spring I go out looking for my little rock. You know, my rock walls are 2 inches tall and have to retrieve the little rocks. So... Yeah, sinking in, sprouting up, all of this.
Let's do some more sinking in.